Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, a conversation with retired general and military analyst Barry McCaffrey on everything from North Korea and Cuba, he thinks those countries will soon fall apart, to Iraq. Will U.S. troops be leaving that country sooner than the presidential candidates are saying? But first, Marine generals have reportedly told the Pentagon that they want to pull their troops out of Iraq and send them to Afghanistan. Right now, only a handful of Marines are fighting in Afghanistan, where there are 26,000 mainly Army troops. 25,000 Marines are currently deployed to Anbar province in western Iraq, where tribal leaders have worked with U.S. forces to quell al-Qaeda-related violence. Tony Perry writes about the possible Marine pullout in the Los Angeles Times. He joins us now. Tony, what's the thinking behind the reported request?
Well, the thinking is that the President of the United States has said a drawdown is in the offing at some point, and it makes sense that that drawdown will be in the Al-Anbar province where the Marines have been. It once was the most violent, turbulent part of Iraq. Now it's considered a success story. So the Marines are thinking ahead. If they're going to be brought out anyway, they want to remain in this fight. They want to remain active in President Bush's war on terror, and they're saying, Afghanistan, we're ready. We're even eager to go to Afghanistan.
And they say that they see the fighting increasing in Afghanistan.
Sure, the Taliban and al-Qaeda are on the move. They're resurgent, no question about that, both along that wild tribal area near Pakistan, but also closer and closer to Kabul. We're hitting a point where Afghanistan might be at a turning point one way or another. The Marines want to be part of that if their mission in Iraq and Al-Anbar province is judged such that they can move out of that.
Well, you're painting the picture that the Marines have painted to you, you know, their reasoning for making this request. But one might say, well, there are plenty of problems in Iraq. They could move to another region in Iraq.
Indeed. And if that's the decision made by the higher authority, that's what they'll do. The Army has taken responsibility for Baghdad and its environs, and the Marines have done Al-Anbar. So the thinking is, once their peace is under control, they'll move elsewhere.
How does this reshuffle the military if, in fact, they do go to Afghanistan? Would they replace the Army troops there? How would that work?
Could be. I think more likely they will come back to California, retrain, then go to Afghanistan, and then the Army units that are rotating out will either come back to the U.S. and stay, or after some refreshment, go back to Iraq. I think ultimately we're looking at Afghanistan being a Marine Corps show. Remember, the Marines were the first conventional troops into Afghanistan to topple the Taliban in 2001 after 9/11. They've been there before. Their Marine generals have been over there just recently getting the lay of the land. So they know Afghanistan, and they're ready to go back.
Well, Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, who's traveling to Moscow, was asked about this by reporters, and he told Reuters during a London stopover that there's no plan on the table. No one has come to him with a proposal. A Marine spokesperson told us the same thing, that this is just a, you know, sort of a free flow of ideas. But you report that Secretary Gates is considering this idea.
Well, he knows of the idea, and I'm sure he hasn't forgotten about it. He convened a session just last week in which this idea was presented. Is there a formal 600-page document on how things would work? No, probably not. But he knows what the Marines want and what they can do and their readiness to go to Afghanistan. With all due respect to the Secretary, I might say that his predecessor once stood up and said there is no plan to move the Marines out of Fallujah. At the very same time, the Marines were actually in trucks moving out of Fallujah. So sometimes information doesn't flow as quickly to the top as you might think.
Well, you reminded us of the Marines, especially from Camp Pendleton in San Diego, being the first conventional troops in Afghanistan after 9/11. And as we all know, troops were infamously pulled out of Afghanistan while they were on the trail of Osama bin Laden and Tora Bora. Is this part of the thinking of the Marines' desire to go back and finish that job?
I think so. I think particularly Marine commanders, there is a sense that it's not finished. They were pulled out to do other duties, and they're ready to go back. And that Afghanistan, which has a much stronger government than Iraq, a much stronger military, really needs help. But it doesn't need the U.S. to carry the entire burden, which has been the case up until just recently in Iraq. I think they have a feeling that their hard work from 2001 could be bolstered if they can go back, finish the case, finish getting the Afghan army on its feet and ready to take over 100%.
Tony Perry of the Los Angeles Times speaking about a proposal to pull Marine troops out of Iraq, send them to Afghanistan. Tony, thanks very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Well, retired General Barry McCaffrey has some thoughts on troops leaving Iraq completely. General McCaffrey served in the U.S. Army for 32 years, including command of the 24th Infantry Division during Operation Desert Storm. After he retired, he served as director of the White House Office of National Drug Policy. Today, he's an adjunct professor of international affairs at West Point and a military analyst for NBC News. He's also a frequent guest on Here and Now from his office in Arlington, Virginia. But this week, he's been in Rhode Island speaking at Brown University, and we want to spend a few minutes with him today, part of our ongoing conversation with military analysts on a range of topics. And General McCaffrey joins us from a studio at Brown in Providence, Rhode Island. Welcome.
Good to be with you, Robin.
You speak on a range of issues, and we're going to do that with you in a moment. We have a list of your PowerPoint presentation, a lot of interesting ideas. But before we do that, before I direct you to some topics, what would you say you'd want Americans to be thinking about as, you know, one of the most important things maybe they're not thinking about right now?
I think the central issue facing 300 million of us is who's the next administration going to be and what are their ideas, what are their concepts, what do they articulate before they get into office they're going to do, not just about Iraq and Afghanistan, but some of the, you know, the huge issues, immigration, Social Security, Medicare. Bluntly, I think either party will elect a president who will largely pull us out of Iraq in the coming 36 months, absent some fundamental change in the way the Iraqis are governing their internal affairs.
You think so? You think so?
Yeah. Oh, this is a loser. You know, the thing's probably 1,000 killed and wounded, $10 billion a month. The American people have walked away from it. So, you know, the wars are not sustainable without the support of the American people over time. My guess would be in the first year of the next administration or so, the new president will take an assessment on where we are and what's possible, and at that point, you'll see a substantial withdrawal. By the way, the U.S. Army is going to unravel at the current deployment rate. With 160,000 troops in combat in Iraq and another 25,000 in Afghanistan, we just can't keep this up. So we're going to wreck the Army in the process of sustaining an under-resourced and now politically unsupported war.
Do you think, as the New York Times wrote in its editorial, that a consequence of pulling the troops out will be that the region will just fall into, I mean, especially Iraq, will just fall apart and so be it? It might have to fight a real intense civil war or break into three parts, and we might just have to watch through fingers over our eyes and let it happen.
Well, I think that's the problem. You know, that's the most likely outcome. You've got this bitter civil war going on between the Shia and the Sunni right now. And in the background, of course, the next shoe to drop will be the Kurds versus the Arabs and the Kurds versus the Turks. The likelihood is that if we left very quickly without establishing some security force in the Iraq, among the Iraqis that was capable of managing internal order, I don't think we're going to get consensus politics. There's going to be a loose federation of some, you know, semi-autonomous federal states. But there has to be a security force that can tamp down all-out civil war, without which we risk destabilizing our friends, and that certainly includes the Gulf states and the Saudis, who view our mess in Iraq as having brought the Persian frontier to their northern border.
On that note, let's look at some of your various lists. And in your presentation, you have 7 observations on Afghanistan, 8 on Iraq, 6 on the war on terror. You also have one entitled "What Is in Our Future." We just spoke a little bit of that, but the order is interesting. The first thing you put on the list is the U.S. economy. You say it will continue to dominate the global marketplace. But number 13 on your list is Iran goes nuclear, producing instability in the Persian Gulf. You know, I think you'd flip those, making Iran number one. Why do you put the global economy at number one?
There's a focus, understandably, on what's going to happen in Iraq, the consequences of the Persian Gulf. I wanted to provide the larger context, which says not happy talk, but look, let's remind ourselves the country is still this enormous economic powerhouse. If you want to invest your money in the future, sure, there's a healthy competition with the European Union. Yes, indeed, there are problems with the Russians, who are bloated with oil revenue and viewing a Putin who's headed toward authoritarianism to reestablish a czardom in the next coming 100 years. So there's plenty of problems out there, but I wanted to underscore the economy is sound, the American people are sound. A lot of our allies, notwithstanding their alienation from our foreign policy under this administration, actually are almost have nowhere to turn. And among those groups, I say, look, our relationship with the Indians, with the Pakistanis, with the Chinese, with the Japanese, with the Saudis, for that matter, have never been better in the country's history. So an attempt to provide larger context to this terrible situation in Iraq.
And you say that, though, about the economy, even though, you know, that we have the trade imbalance with China, so much more is being sent into the country than Americans are, you know, sending out?
I'm not an economist. I know just enough to be dangerous. But I have always asserted that the current administration hasn't acted like a Republican regime, for God's sakes. You know, where's the fiscal conservatism? Where's the balance of income and outgo? Slash taxes, raise expenditures. Clearly, there's a foreign trade deficit of huge proportions that cannot go on forever unchecked. And clearly, in a domestic economic situation, I don't see how, you know, you push off the cost of homeland security, the war on terror, Medicare, Social Security, put it on future generations without having some attempt to pay for what we're doing. So, by the way, the Congress is wrapped up in this. You know, this is under, I tell people, under Article 1 of the Constitution, it defines the duties for Congress, and that certainly includes a substantial role in both foreign policy and national security.
We're talking with retired General Barry McCaffrey, an analyst who's looking into the future of the U.S. for us. You write, the situation in Afghanistan will improve. North Korea, though, will come apart. This is, again, in your peering into the future. You say it'll come apart, even though there's a paper deal for North Korea to disarm. How do you see it falling apart?
It's hard to get around having a fundamentally illogical regime. Yeah. Marxism doesn't work. It's particularly the sort of self-reliance model of Marxism. North Korea is run by a sort of weak-kneed sociopath who's murdered 2 million of his own people. They don't have energy supplies. The only thing they can export that has value are missiles, nuclear technology, and drugs. They're actually producing methamphetamines and heroin and pushing this out in the international marketplace. So the North Korean people are in terrible distress. They're fleeing across the northern border into China. So the six-power talks, which thank God both Secretary Colin Powell and now Dr. Condi Rice are trying to shepherd along, is an attempt to buffer the ultimate self-implosion of the North Korean economy and political system. It's going to happen. The question is when and with what consequence. And our interest, certainly the Japanese, South Koreans, Russian, Chinese, and others, is to try and avoid some spasm of violence as they finally come apart.
That's retired Army General Barry McCaffrey with a rather bleak picture of the future he sees in North Korea. Well, after a break, we're going to keep that tone, and we'll ask the general what he thinks is going to happen in Cuba after Castro. We'll also get his thoughts about the recent debate over waterboarding, you know, and possible treatment of detainees. Also, just a reminder, later in the program, we'll speak with a Florida police chief who says unmanned surveillance drones can play a positive role finding lost kids, the lost elderly, but will police also spy on Americans with these drones? We'll have that conversation back in 1 minute, here and now. We're back with some more from retired Army General Barry McCaffrey, now a professor at West Point and a military analyst for NBC News. We're getting his thinking today on a wide range of issues, Iraq, Afghanistan, and some predictions for the future. Before the break, we were talking about North Korea. General, you also have some thoughts on Cuba. You see a new refugee crisis after Castro dies.
I think when he goes, his brother Raul holds it together for some period of time. But I'd put an upper cap on it of a couple of years, at the end of which, you know, I think a lot of Cubans are going to say, these fools are never going to change. We'll just reestablish another new generation of dictatorship, and they're going to try and get out of there. So I want us to be ready to handle potentially a huge humanitarian crisis. And, oh, by the way, my argument would be let's get in there now, open an embassy, lift the trade embargo, lift the absolutely senseless restrictions on U.S. Tourist travel to Cuba. Let's flood the islands with curious Americans and start reestablishing relationships with the next generation that's going to run Cuba.
Do you think Castro would allow the U.S. to strike that kind of deal?
I think it'd be a nightmare for him. But, you know, he's been saying for 40 years now, these gringos are causing my problems. They've isolated us. That's why we're buying shoddy Eastern European and Russian goods instead of, you know, the obvious trading partner, for God's sakes, with Cuba is in Florida and Louisiana and Mississippi. So basically, I'd, you know, probably announce the day after the election with no preconditions. We're now lifting the trade embargo. And any American who wishes to go to Cuba is welcome to get in a plane and go there.
Hmm. Well, let's take a look at your list of six observations on the war on terrorism. Some of them seem contradictory. You say the major terrorist organizations have been badly damaged, but they've morphed into other groups. You say the U.S. is definitely safer, but you agree with others that the terrorists will strike the U.S. again. And you also seem to be talking yourself, a military man, out of a job. You say the real national security challenges for the next president are about diplomacy and economic development.
Oh, absolutely. You know, we've got to use our economic muscle to try and change ground reality in places like Colombia with 3 million internal refugees or Afghanistan with a huge suffering population. By the way, we are. We're spending a lot of money in Afghanistan. We're turning that situation around. But I think we've gotten way too unilateral. We can't take military action ever again without grabbing the regional or international allies that would share our same concern about the situation and saying we need you to help. And we didn't do that going into either Afghanistan or Iraq. And it was a huge misjudgment.
Where do you come down on where some of the claimed security that the U.S. now has might have come from? The fact that Americans have given up some civil rights, warrantless wiretapping, the Bush administration just won big in a Supreme Court decision about executive privilege, not allowing a German citizen to sue the CIA for reportedly mistakenly detaining him. Where do you come down on some of what the current administration says are these necessary erosions?
Clearly, a society, a democratic rule-based society that's threatened, ought to devise rules that allows it to aggressively defend itself, without which you move into oblivion. So I'm absolutely in favor of an aggressive, stiff national security and domestic security. Now, having said that, I think we wandered afield. You know, we got to remind ourselves what we're most proud of in this country is not this enormous economic wealth we've acquired. It's the Bill of Rights. So at the end of the day, what we need to do is we want domestic security checked by elected officials, and we want a separate branch of government, the judicial system, to give permission for law enforcement to listen to our telephones, sneak into our houses. You talk about a no-brainer. We want to be absolutely clear that no foreign nationals that fall under our military or intelligence service control, that no U.S. agency that has detainees under their control should be allowed to abuse them. We got to remember our value system. When, you know, my son's a soldier fighting overseas right now. When we look at how we treat detainees under our control, we ought to say, what is the equivalent treatment to our own young men and women when captive that we would tolerate? And I think that means Geneva Convention, rule of law, access by the International Red Cross, you know, these tortured explanations that are coming out of the system right now, which we apparently are trying to persuade ourselves that waterboarding and slapping people in the head and disorienting them with hunger, thirst, or extreme temperatures, for God's sakes, it's like some grade B Nazi movie. We can't do that. We got to remind ourselves publicly, and then privately we got to follow our own dictums.
Retired General Barry McCaffrey, by the way, where is your son?
I don't want to say. He's in combat with a parachute infantry brigade, and they are great kids. They're doing a terrific job. They're taking casualties. They're building bridges and schools. And I know all of us share a huge sense of pride in the armed forces.
Well, we wish him well. And just with that in mind, I want to ask you one last thing. You know, recently there was a sort of a kerfuffle talk show host Rush Limbaugh saying that soldiers who spoke out against the way the war in Iraq was being executed were phony soldiers or something like that. Did you have thoughts on that?
Oh, he ought to be ashamed of himself. I mean, what an outrage. You know, these soldiers, particularly enlisted soldiers, give up none of their constitutional rights when they're in uniform. Obviously, they may have viewpoints. They may vote. And to express a viewpoint on this terribly mismanaged war in Iraq is their right and due. And by the way, it's helpful to the American people to hear what genuine 82nd Airborne soldiers are saying in Iraq, the eight young men that signed a letter to the editor of the New York Times. So, you know, Mr. Limbaugh ought to be, I think, ought to retract his statement. This is their right, and thank God for their courage, their ability to put themselves in harm's way. And by the way, a lot of us, 3.5 million of us, are Vietnam veterans. You know, we watched McNamara and these people put us through a meat grinder for 7 years, 58,000 killed, 300,000 wounded. You can bet your bottom dollar we're going to speak up.
That's retired General Barry McCaffrey, an analyst, also adjunct professor of international affairs at West Point. General McCaffrey, thanks so much for weighing in with us.
Yeah, good to be with you, Robin.
Okay, take a quick look ahead. Tomorrow on Here and Now, who wins the Nobel Peace Prize? And still ahead today, will it be Al Gore? Back after the news, Here and Now. Yesterday, we spoke with a correspondent for The Economist magazine who told us about British police for the first time using a 3-foot-long remote-controlled drone with a video camera on board to keep an eye on crowds at a music festival last summer. We spoke with a legal affairs writer who thinks that's a bad idea, an erosion of civil liberties. Well, some U.S. police departments want to use drones. Some have already bought one called the Cyberbug, and the Federal Aviation Administration is considering letting police use them. And they say they have a different agenda than surveillance. We turn now to Don Shinneman. He's chief of public safety for Holly Hill, Florida. He chairs the Aviation Committee of the International Association of Chiefs of Police. So, Chief, make your case. What can you do with drones that you can't do with other technology or with people?
For all three arenas in public safety, police, fire, and emergency management, air support is frankly critical in a lot of cases to the success of our operation. I'll give you an example from the police side. In my community here, we have several very large adult living facilities. Not uncommon for an Alzheimer's patient to wander off the grounds. My situation may be atypical in that we have a helicopter support available to us. Most law enforcement agencies, most communities in the country do not have air support available to them.
It's too expensive?
Yes, it's a very, very expensive proposition. The most inexpensive, fully equipped police helicopter is well over $1 million.
And drones? How much? Are, you know, that much less?
The Cyberbug, I think, is in the neighborhood of $30,000. Plus, the kids that we hire nowadays grew up playing video games. So you can train them to operate a Cyberbug. So you're not training a pilot. It's not a full-time assignment. You can deploy those things right from the back of a police car. Some of them are carried in what literally is a tube. You open the tube, pull out the system, and hand launch it and operate it with, you know, kind of a joystick kind of remote control thing. So it's immediate.
Other police chiefs have talked about wanting to use drones to find lost children. If there's
Absolutely.
If there's an alert, they can get quickly up in the air and look down on, let's say, cars if they have a license plate. Others have talked about using it for border surveillance. And we understand a handful of police chiefs tried a small plane, but the FAA stopped them.
The rapid advance of the technology has overwhelmed the ability of the regulatory environment, and we are having difficulty with the FAA. The FAA has essentially taken a position that you can't operate them in the U.S. airspace system. We challenge that. We think we can do it safely. I'm a pilot of both airplanes and helicopters, and I don't personally want to be darting around unmanned aerial vehicles either, but we can employ deploy them safely now.
Let's take up that issue of safety. Some drones have crashed. The Los Angeles Police Department's cyber bug crashed in a demonstration for the media. It wasn't a very good, you know, PR campaign for it. And in Arizona, a surveillance drone used along the Mexican border crashed near some homes. You know, there is concern about them.
Sure. And I think 60% of all aircraft crashes, manned aircraft crashes, are the result of pilot error. You know, for the most part, and I'm speaking now in terms of micro, what's called micro unmanned aerial systems, that somewhere in the 5 to 10 pound range with, you know, a 2 to 3 foot wingspan, that even if it comes down, it's not, you know, unless it whacks somebody right on the top of the head, it's not going to cause any serious damage or serious injury. What I advocate for the micro UAS is that they be operated within line of sight of the operator, and that they be operated at an altitude of, say, 500 feet above the surface or less, so that you're really not in the airspace that's being where manned aircraft are being operated. Now, the ones, like the one operated by the Border Patrol that was operating at about 18,000 feet, where you're up with airliners and those sorts of things, absolutely have to be tightly controlled. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, in law enforcement, fire, emergency management, we could operate the micro UASs within line of sight at a relatively low altitude, accomplish what we need to do, and do that safely.
These are just, you're saying they'd be in the same category as little model airplanes that people fly out in fields all the time.
Very much so.
Well, what about these small insect-sized drones? We, by the way, can connect listeners to a website that demonstrates them. We'll do that. But the Washington Post reports that activists at an anti-war rally swore that they saw them, you know, these little bugs flying in the air, but, you know, they thought they looked mechanical. Do you know if they're in use by police?
No. I can pretty conclusively tell you that there's no, at least at the state and local level, there's nobody that's using them. And as I've become more familiar with the technology, that's in the very early developmental stages, really being done by research institutions. I find the technology very exciting, that that, you know, that technology, we're really at the brink of what I think is the next generation of aviation, which is unmanned aerial systems, from the tiniest to the largest, what is now a manned aircraft or will be unmanned in the future.
Well, you find it exciting, but I'm sure you're aware that there are people who fear it. They think it's going to infringe on civil liberties.
Sure.
You know, right now police largely have to get a warrant to look inside your home, for instance. Are you worried that these drones would be perceived as spy vehicles by people and erode the trust people have in their cop on the street?
I share the same civil liberties concerns. You know, when you can, the technology is headed towards having a unmanned aerial system that is the size of a fly or a moth. I've seen literature on ones that are the size of a moth. It's like, you know, back in the 20s and 30s when wiretapping first, that technology first became available. You know, that is now so tightly controlled. You can't even possess wiretapping equipment. If you conduct an illegal wiretap, that is a felony.
Well, but I just have to rush in to say that, of course, under the new Bush administration thinking, there is warrantless wiretapping. People are being wiretapped without knowing it.
Yeah, well, and, you know, for national security purposes, and again, I think any responsible law enforcement official would share the same civil liberties concerns. But we do, you know, not that there haven't been problems, but I'd like to think that 99.9% of us follow the rule of law. That law will evolve over time and give us guidelines on when it can't be used. And in fact, there's already those things in place now that says that we can't invade privacy of an individual with technology without a warrant to do so.
Don Shinneman is Chief of Public Safety for Holly Hill, Florida. He also chairs the Aviation Committee of the International Association of Chiefs of Police. He's in favor of some use of remote-controlled drones for police work. Chief Shinneman, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Robin, my pleasure.
And an FAA spokesman tells us that agency is working with some police departments to conduct drone tests over populated areas. To see pictures and videos of some of the drones, go to our website, here-now.org. And a quick note, get your iPods ready. Tomorrow we'll visit again the busiest and some say the best contemporary classical music composer today. What is Osvaldo Golchow up to? And still ahead today, jazz singer Dede Bridgewater finds her musical roots in the African country of Mali. You're listening to Here and Now. I first heard it from a neighbor last week. Psst, I have it on good authority that Newsweek is going to write about Al Gore's presidential and Nobel Peace Prize chances. Pass it on. Well, sure enough, this week Newsweek, MSNBC, and the New York Times all wrote about a move to draft Al Gore into the presidential race, and they spoke of his chances of winning the Nobel Peace Prize for his work in bringing the problem of global warming to the world's attention. Did the reports chronicle a reality, or did the Whisper campaign create the reports? Well, there's definitely a move to draft Al Gore in 2008, but with the Peace Prize due to be announced tomorrow, we wondered, does lobbying help or hurt when it comes to the Nobel? For a look behind that curtain, we turn to Alistair Doyle. He joins us from Oslo. He's Reuters environment correspondent and has covered the Nobel Prizes for many years. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
And what do you think? Is there a real chance of Gore winning, or is this wishful whispering that, you know, his backers might think make Gore look better as a presidential candidate?
Sadly, I have absolutely no idea, but the bookmakers put Al Gore as the favorite, but I think he'd be very lucky to win personally. I think that the committee may be a bit worried about the fact that they gave the prize already to a leading Democrat, to Jimmy Carter in 2002, and that Al Gore, a second top Democrat during one Republican presidency, might seem a bit too much for George Bush.
Well, but that's interesting, though, that bookmakers are betting on him. But there are 181 other names on the list. First of all, what are some of the bigger names that are jumping out that other people are speaking of?
Well, there's quite a lot of people are reckoning that it might go to some climate campaigner this year. If not Al Gore, the other people on the list here are Sheila Watt-Cloutier, a Canadian Inuit activist who's been warning about the melting of the Arctic ice for years. There's also been reports this year, of course, by the UN climate panel warning of the effects of global warming and saying that people are pretty much to blame for the problem. It would be a big redefinition of what peace is, in a sense, if they give it to a climate campaigner. You know, on the other hand, there are many other problems in the world. Some people suggest they could make a stand about a lack of democracy in China the year before the Summer Olympics in Beijing. Underscore the need for more democracy in Russia, for example.
And we're reminded last year the prize went to Muhammad Yunus, who was the Bangladeshi microfinancier. Is that how you'd call
Indeed,
him?
Yeah,
and some
yeah.
said at the time, well, what does that have to do with peace?
Exactly. He was also a sign of, you know, how many surprises the Nobel Committee can spring on us.
By the way, remind us, we know these names because a name only gets out if a nominator gives the name out. Who makes the nominations?
Well, quite a lot of people can make nominations. There's no real honor in getting on the list of nominees. There's been, you know, Adolf Hitler's made himself into the list of nominees 1 year, as did former Yugoslav president Slobodan Milosevic. Michael Jackson's even been on the list as well in recent years, I think. But many people can make nominations. Any member of parliament can make a nomination. University professors of law or political science, for example, can make nominations. Former prize winners can make nominations. So it's quite a long list of people who are eligible to make these.
We mentioned the lobbying. There's a lot of it going on. The director of the Nobel Institute told you that it's subtle and not so subtle. I mean, they get thousands of letters. They get visits?
They get visits from people. They get emails. He says people phone him up. People call him up and say, can you come and meet us? He said even one time that some people turned up and asked him to come down into a car where they were all going to offer him a suitcase with something in it. He's not sure quite what was inside the suitcase because he walked away, but it might have been a bribe. 1 year, some people sent in 750,000 signatures in support of a candidate, and he says that he gets turned off from them.
Does that mean that, you know, the campaign, for instance, for Al Gore might not be in his favor?
You never know. The director of the Institute, Guy Lunderstad, won't discuss who the campaigns have been in favor of. You know, clearly Al Gore is well-liked among many Norwegians. The head of the committee has met him, and afterwards he said it was a very important message from Al Gore. So Al Gore is certainly very high on the committee's radar.
Alistair Doyle in Oslo, the environment correspondent for Reuters, sort of handicapping tomorrow's Nobel Peace Prize announcement. Alistair, thanks so much.
Thanks for that, Robin. Thanks.
And up next, jazz singer D.D. Bridgewater. That's in 1 minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Trace the roots of American blues and you'll arrive at the kora, a stringed instrument indigenous to Africa and especially well-known in the northern nation of Mali. D.D. Bridgewater, the Grammy Award-winning jazz singer, traced that musical lineage.
It was so good to me.
She scatted with Sonny Rollins and Dizzy Gillespie, won a Tony for her performance of Glinda the Good Witch in Broadway's The Wiz. Then D.D. Bridgewater went to Mali on a humanitarian mission and came back with Red Earth, A Malian Journey, a new CD that explores the rhythms and traditions of Africa. And she joins us in the studio with more. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Robin.
We should say a mix of Malian and American and other music, but with Malian instruments.
Exactly. Malian instruments, Malian singers, griots.
Let's talk about the griots. These are the storytellers. They've passed down traditional African stories, since the 12th century?
Yeah. I'm doing some griot songs on Red Earth, A Malian Journey, and those songs date back to the 12th century. But the griots also tell stories about historical events, important families, because, you know, in Africa, for the most part, it's been an oral culture.
There's CNN.
That's a very nice way to put it. CNN, live and in living color.
Let's listen to a song called The Griots or Sakadugo.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Let's listen.
The stories that are told of mighty hunters by griots. Down through the years they go, keeping the history of Sakadugo alive in our hearts. Praise to the hunters of Sako.
The lyrics sound so literal in English, you know, not a lot of irony or...
No, I purposely wrote the lyrics simple. I didn't do like literal translations. I did adaptations from the translations that I was given.
Yeah. Someone on our staff noted the griot singers are a keeper of the cultural memory, much like Homer was for the ancient Greeks, or
yes,
the Bible even is the Old Testament for the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
You know, bring that griot storytelling to the American South, because you also said that Red Earth, you know, is mm-hmm. the title. It's the Red Earth of Mali, but does it also remind you of the Red Earth of, what did you say, Memphis?
Memphis, where I was born.
So make
yes.
that connection.
I have always had a very strong pull towards Red Earth all through my life. Anytime that I'm somewhere where there's Red Earth, I have to stop. I have to get out of the car. I have to touch it. I sometimes take off my shoes and I just need to feel it. And
really?
it inspires me. So kind of not exactly because of the Red Earth, I decided that I wanted to find my African heritage. I listened to music from West Africa, and it was Malian music that just caught me every time. And I decided to go to Mali. And Mali, of course, like much of Africa, has red earth. But the red earth in Mali is so deep and so rich.
And you traced your roots to at least some of that dirt, at least to West Africa, if not to Mali.
No, I didn't trace it all the way to Mali, but I do believe very strongly that it is Mali. I have met African, you know, black Africans from various countries throughout my adult life, and I have always been told that I am Malian
huh.
because of my traits.
So you feel you found home. That's interesting.
I feel very strongly I found home.
And you returned there in 2006. You were invited to tour villages with local UN workers, and you traveled with singer and women's rights activist Oumu Sangare. What did you find there?
The United Nations thing is I'm one of the very first ambassadors for the Food and Agriculture Organization, which has a grassroots program, and they make these cooperatives with women. And they give them between $2,000 to $3,000. Those women are then placed with usually it's two people from another country that live in a similar manner, and the two people usually stay in the village for up to a year.
Well, you mentioned the strong feminine influence that you felt, and mm-hmm. you said you wanted to reflect that with your music. I want to listen to Tata Kuyate's composition Bambo, or No More. And we understand the song created an outrage over the practice of forced marriage in Mali in the 60s.
Well, not only an outrage, but the government abolished forced marriage due to this song. Bambo, come on, Nana, baby, no more will you trick us with pretty lies. No more will you see tears fall from our eyes. No more.
Dee Dee Bridgewater's version of Tata Kuyate's Bambo, or No More. It's on her new CD, Red Earth, which is both Malian music and American music, but played with Malian instruments. I want to speak about one of the American songs, because it's okay. Nina Simone's 1966 song that really took closely held racial stereotypes and put it right out there.
Oh, yeah.
Here in America.
Yes.
This is her song, For Women. Why
yes.
did you include this song?
Because For Women is a song that gave me a sense of pride in being a black female. I was 16 at the time, and because of that song, I began to wear my hair naturally instead of, straightening it. I began to look at Africa in a different way, and I actually used it as my thesis when I was at Michigan State. And because for me, it's just about the different grades of color of black women. We have a saying, the lighter you are, the more chances you have of fitting into white world. Mm. And so I wanted to pay homage to Nina. I just thought it was very fitting for this project.
My father was rich and white. He forced my mother late one night. What do they call me? My name is Saffronia. My name is Saffronia.
There's this connection that, you were trying to get at between the red earth that you loved in the South and mm-hmm. the red earth of Mali.
Mm-hmm.
Here's Nina Simone, an activist woman who's, so angry at many things, that she moved to France at one point.
She also moved to Ghana.
Yeah. And you bring us the voices of African women who mm-hmm. sang in protest of forced marriage.
Mm-hmm.
It sort of becomes a real global stew.
Yeah.
At the end.
Yeah. Truly, each time that I went to Mali and to Bamako especially, I ended up sitting in with all of these groups, and some of them didn't speak French at all. And just slid right into whatever they were doing, either through scatting or I started making up lyrics, which is something else that I hadn't been doing. And it was just this organic, totally inspired experience.
Dee Dee Bridgewater's new CD is Red Earth, A Malian Journey. For more on the CD, her tour, or Jazz Set, the public radio program she hosts, go to our website, here-now.org. Dee Dee, thank you so much.
You are so welcome, Robin. Thank you for the invitation to come on the show.
You can listen to Here and Now live each weekday at noon Eastern Time by going to WBUR.org and clicking on the Listen Live button. You can also find us each weekday at noon Eastern on XM Radio Channel 133.